Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am one of your co-hosts, Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. And unfortunately, my co-founder, Will, isn't able to join us today, but he's behind the scenes helping us with production. Shout out to Will. We got a great guest today, Alex from ClimateX. He's a commercial strategy manager with ClimateX. We're very excited to have you on board, Alex. Welcome to the pod.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Excited to be here.
We've not talked about, you know, your specific slice of the market yet on the podcast, Alex. So can you just give our audience a quick overview of what your team does at ClimateX and what y'all are working on?
We're a global climate risk data provider, and we cater that data to various industries, including banking, insurance, real estate, utilities, you name it.
Sounds like a very specific niche in the market. So can you just give our audience a bit of background on like how did it get started? How did it come up in the first place?
Yeah, for sure. So our founders, Leckie and Camille, come from banking. They've worked in risk management for over 15 years. I've worked closely to the policy sector. And initially, their plan, I think, was to start a consultancy firm and perhaps support a lot of these institutions in assessing their exposure to climate risk. But when it came time to looking for some of that data, they realized that there wasn't much out there. And for some of that data that was out there, the outputs were not necessarily tailored to the use case of financial institutions. So that's where ClimateX came about.
Very cool. Well, as we typically do on the pod, we like to jump into some headlines, and we shared a few with you. And, you know, a lot of these are about just like climate tech and entrepreneurship and, you know, investment. So the first piece was from GLG Insights. And just curious, at a general level, you know, the piece talks about great ways that climate tech entrepreneurs can, you know, market what they're doing to investors. Curious to hear what's worked well for you all in terms of marketing yourself to investors and how you think climate tech entrepreneurs should be doing this.
So first and foremost, when you look at the, you know, impacts of climate change, they're already being felt. Whether you turn on the news, podcast, listen to the radio, you name it, there's an extreme weather events that tends to make the headlines, right? We can talk about the recent Hurricane Ian in Florida or the floods in Pakistan. What we're seeing is the probability and the severity of these events are increasing. So it's happening more and more often. I can't remember where I read this, but the cost of these events are expected to rise to $27 trillion USD by 2050. And that's under a no additional action scenario. So what that means is, you know, if we continue to live as is, no policies, we don't cut down on emissions, right? By 2050, those costs are expected to hit $27 trillion, which is astronomical, right? The second point is, I would say, around regulations. So we're seeing governments and central banks worldwide deploying policies, legislations, and regulations to really force the agenda on the climate risk assessments across the global economy. And it's taking a bit of a top-down approach. So initially, it's targeting financial institutions. So think banks, insurers, asset managers, you name it. And they're being asked to drive that transition into properly pricing climate risk. And then this has a bit of a trickle-down effect to large corporates, SMEs, and so on. So that's the second point. So the first one is around, well, we know we see these risks kind of evolving. The probability of those events is increasing, and the impacts are quite astronomical. The second one is we're seeing this movement led by governments and central banks driving the agenda on climate change and climate risk. And then the third one is around reputation. Firms who don't comply or don't necessarily show progress are starting to get penalized. One example I like to use is Deutsche Bank, specifically their asset management arm. Well, they got recently rated, and I think it was for a $1 trillion greenwashing inquiry. No companies wants to take that hit, whether it's on the branding side of things. That type of raid really sent a message to regulators that they are taking this seriously. So companies now can either take the lead and drive change, or they can be left behind. Reading a lot of these TCFD reports that many corporates have already released, I think there's already two-thirds that have already set ambitious net zero targets set by 2050 at the very latest, which is great. But now they actually have to act on it. Although that was a nice PR announcement in the last year or two, well, they now need to start driving that decarbonization, improve their supply chain, and they can't solely just rely on carbon offsets moving forward. And that's where tech solutions really come in.
That's powerful. Yeah, I love the way you set the scene there too, in terms of like, okay, here's this global challenge that we're all facing, you know, but also it's trickling down into markets and changing the priorities of investors and banks and funders broadly. And then, you know, the third piece of like, you know, these organizations, these companies are starting to see real impacts in terms of their bottom line, fines, regulatory sort of, you know, changes that are impacting how they move in the market, things like that. So that's really helpful for our audience to have that context. Curious about the venture capital piece specifically. So is ClimateX a venture-backed company?
Yeah, it is.
And what's that like journey been like? Like how have you all experienced interacting with VCs and their sort of interest in your particular product?
So for me, and also for the founders, this was completely new to us, right? We didn't necessarily know how to approach it. And I kind of tagged along for the journey. But the first thing that I noticed is the structure of climate tech. It differs a lot from traditional tech investing. Climate tech companies need a bit more than just an asset-light software solution, right? So if you're looking to scale into new regions and such, it's not as just easy as setting up shop and then starting to sell your solution. It takes considerable investment upfront from a R&D standpoint, whether it's on the hardware to really drive that innovation. To give you an example, in year one, 3/4 of our team until recently was basically academia. So think climate scientists and engineers. So it was really product focused. There was a lot of risk behind that, right? And for VCs, they see that risk. You can't really pinpoint the valuation and revenue takes a little longer to come in. So yeah.
The Washington Post piece that we share with you, like they talk about, and you kind of alluded to this, like climate tech being pretty different than like traditional tech investing. And like the climate tech includes, you know, asset light software solutions, but also like investment in manufacturing, hardware, research and development for product innovation. So global venture funds to some degree have to adapt if they want to like, they want in on that energy transition, as you said earlier. And maybe it means like different sort of gestation periods and exit timing for these climate tech funds. So it sounds like you all have experienced a bit of that difference.
That's spot on. And I guess to tie on the academia piece, I think it was the Silicon Valley Bank. They came out with a climate tech report recently, and they're saying that a lot of these new climate tech companies that are coming about, 10% of their staff is actually academia now. So that's a bit of an adjustment as well.
I feel like there's just like loads of really interesting insights and data coming out of this world. And it's like, you know, fast moving. So along those lines, curious about, you know, one of the pieces we talked about was just using AI to fight climate change. You guys use any kind of advanced like machine learning or AI as part of the work that you do or any of the, you know, companies that you work with there?
So AI is a cheeky one. The simplest way to answer it is AI alone is definitely not going to solve the climate crisis, and it shouldn't. It could be used sensibly, and I like the word sensibly. If it's applied sensibly to fill gaps in some of your data, whether that data is to help identify or forecast risk, vulnerabilities, potential disruptions arising from the impacts of climate change, that's good, but it shouldn't solely be focused on. There's a great article that our head of science, Dr. Claire Burke, wrote called Don't Put All Your Eggs in One Basket. The premise is around the black box versus the glass box approach when it comes to machine learning. Regulators, auditors, clients, they want to understand how you got to these data outputs, and that requires transparency. So for instance, if I'm saying, oh, you have a portfolio of assets, let's say residential assets, and 10% of those assets are at high risk of flooding in a specific area, what's the first thing you might ask? Well, first you might say, oh, damn. But then the first thing you'll ask is how you got to these metrics. And unlike a glass box approach, where that is quite transparent, right? Machine learning, if it's solely relied upon, creates a bit of that black box where it's really hard to interpret or explain how you got to these outputs. And when you're working with risk management teams or dealing with auditors, they don't like that. In this case, what you want to do is perhaps have the best of both worlds, and you can't, right? So as long as it's properly applied, you can supplement your methodology with AI or machine learning. And in the case of ClimateX, we use physical models with the addition of machine learning, and that helps satisfy both regulators who require transparency and our users who need detailed information at the asset level.
That's really cool. I like how you painted the picture and you nailed our data science question, but like, you know, how that it serves both sides, you know, it serves both like the regulators and the users, and how that's like a really nice sort of marriage of the two needs, you know, kind of on both sides there. And you're framing the marketplace, as it were, really well. So appreciate that. You've given us kind of like the high level for ClimateX. We'd love to hear a bit more about like the origin story and, you know, just like, you know, what were some of the early sort of things that came out where you're like, okay, this needs to be a bigger scale solution as it has developed into ClimateX. How did it kind of get started in the first place?
Yeah. So building on to, you know, the story I initially said, well, ClimateX has been around for over 2 years. How I got in touch with ClimateX is a bit different. I moved to London in the middle of the pandemic. I was looking to pivot into this specific sector. And through some networking, actually through Finimize, I got in touch with Lucky. At that time, he only had a pitch deck. So there wasn't much more to it. But at the time, I was unemployed. I was looking to soak my teeth in this new opportunity. I knew I was pivoting from, you know, my experience was mainly consumer goods. I knew I had to pivot into tech. And that transition was quite hard. So I kind of offered the support in any way I can. And that brought me up to speed on the industry. But yeah, we've been around for 2 years, went through two rounds of investment. The first year was really spent figuring out the best ways to package our incredible data and cater it to different industry verticals. So again, banking, insurance, real estate, utilities, you name it. We know we have these outputs, right? But each industry had different use cases and challenges. And the last thing we wanted to do is try to boil the ocean. So we had to be quite strategic as to what were the lanes that we wanted to focus on. Banking was one of them because Lucky and Camille came from that specific industry. So that was a no-brainer. But we started getting a lot of inbound from real estate as well, which obviously took a bit of our attention. And because we had that lean team, I can tell you right now, the days were quite long. So the first year was really spent running some of these proof of concepts or proof of values, as they call it, with some of these different prospective clients. At the time, we only had, you know, modeled a specific area in the UK. I think it was 10% of the UK, but we wanted to get these outputs out and really get as much feedback that would help us really refine our offering as we continue to scale across the UK. By end of year one, that's really when we hit the ground running. So we had a product, we were able to cater to UK-based clients. And most of my time this year has really been spent client facing and, you know, developing our sales pipeline, refining the sales process, obviously meeting and securing clients and being that conduit to the product and science team with any of that client insights that would help, again, refine that offering. And simultaneously, and kudos to our team, they worked on scaling our data and offering globally, right? So across Western Europe and North America. And what we've done in the last year or last 18 months is just incredible on that front. Because like I said, you can't just enter a market and start selling that data. The science team has to work with the product team. They got to come up with a sound methodology. They got to do a lot of testing, validation, ensure that the data outputs are correct. A lot of work has gone through that. And it's really nice to see that, you know, we're starting to reap the benefits from it.
Yeah, and I'm curious, what's the like typical size of the clients you work with or size of your engagements?
So it varies quite a lot. The moment you go with a financial institution, think a bank or an insurance company, that sales cycle could easily be over a year. It takes a lot more handholding. Obviously, the contract size will be a lot bigger, but you know, it requires A, proving that you know you're a viable company, first and foremost, running some proof of concepts. And most of the time, it's really testing and ensuring that those outputs that you offer really meet their needs. That can take quite some time, right? And then based on where you started initiating these conversations with these institutions, they might not necessarily have that budget locked in for the year. So that conversation can drag on for quite some time. And they're large institutions. So there's a lot of multi-threading that happens as well, right? You want to be able to start a conversation with a specific team, let's say on the risk management team. Then they also have an asset management team that might be interested. So it takes a lot of time to kind of get the ball rolling with those institutions. And then on the other side, you have, I wouldn't say smaller companies, but maybe a bit more nimble companies in real estate. Obviously, check size will be a bit smaller, but they can operate a lot faster. Most of the time, they don't necessarily need as much handholding as, per se, institutions on the banking front. They require something a bit more self-serve. So we'll offer them perhaps our online platform, which they can log in, run their own assessments. Whereas banks, on the other hand, probably just want access to the raw data because they have an extensive team of data scientists that can work with that data. So we have an API. So the offer varies quite a lot based on what their needs are.
What are some of your favorite success stories from, you know, maybe like one or two of your favorites from the first, you know, really 2 years of your work at ClimateX?
I have to say the speed at which we delivered Spectra, that online platform was not an easy thing to deliver. And there's some really cool features on that front, whether it's just these interactive heat maps, diving in at the specific asset level, or generating a report that's really custom to your portfolio of assets, which a lot of companies would tend to spend a lot of consultancy fees to get something similar, right? But we can get it on the spot now. I think that's one. And then again, I got to give credit to our incredible team because what we've done in those 18 months and really scaling our offering so that we can cater to those international clients who have assets outside of the UK on the global stage, that made a huge difference for us. And we knew we had to get that done quite rapidly to ensure that we stay, you know, on par with or obviously better than our competitors.
Yeah, and you sort of already dived into this a bit, but like you mentioned Spectra and the heat map. Any other favorite tools that your team really loves or you've seen clients really, really enjoy in their work?
Yeah, definitely. So funny thing on the heat maps, I actually asked their team what was their favorite feature. And it turns out it's the one feature they don't like. And the reason why is because they spent so much time perfecting it. But I would say the other one is around our loss modeling component where, you know, we translate these climate metrics into financial metrics that really matter to our end clients and be able to translate that. We're basically calculating how these various climate related weather events can impact one asset. But when you add a, you know, a British pound amount or a dollar amount or even a percentage to that impact, it really hits home with our clients.
That seems like, just to pause on that for a second, that seems like a massive achievement. And you know, some people will say, okay, there's a moral case, obviously, for addressing climate change, obviously, and a humanitarian case, but like creating a model where companies can really understand how much they're going to lose, which will then empower them to kind of act on it, something like that. You know, it seems so groundbreaking. I'm wondering if there's like the other side of that. Are you able to create models where companies can sort of look forward and say, hey, we want to move forward with this product or service and assess the impact it's going to have on the climate? Is there a forward-looking portion of this?
Oh my God, yeah. Great point. And I'm sorry I didn't address that. What we do is, obviously, it is forward-looking projections. So looking at baseline all the way to 2100. So taking into account these various climate scenarios and seeing exactly how your assets or the impact on your assets will evolve over time. So that monetary amount tied to, you know, the loss modeling component definitely does change over time.
That's massive. As you explain the product, I'm sort of like, all right, what's government's role in this? Like, why isn't government doing this, like in partnership with companies? So it's super curious to hear how you all have worked with governments or, you know, cities, towns, counties, municipalities, things like that.
One of the main reasons we picked the UK to start off was they paved the road when it comes to climate risk disclosures a few years ago. And not this summer, last summer, they had their first climate stress test exercise where, you know, many firms across banking insurance had to partake in. Although there wasn't any capital requirements tied to it, it was an exploratory exercise that would basically define or help the Bank of England and the PRA assess how climate risk should be, you know, accounted for. So that was step one. And then this summer, we saw the ECB, so the European Central Bank, also run a similar exercise. Next year, it was just recently announced last week in the US, they are going to be conducting a similar exercise as well. So we're kind of seeing this path and we've been following these regulations as they were deploying, but it's not moving fast enough. I mean, kudos to those teams as well. It's a nascent space, right? There's a lot to learn, a lot to digest. And these initial policies and regulations are not going to be perfect and they probably never will be. But, and with that said, companies now, they have this opportunity to kind of step in. And instead of waiting for these policies to really settle in, they can take the lead. And that's what we tend to tell our clients is you can either be a leader. If you decide to wait, it's going to be too late. So might as well kind of take that step forward. We know it's not perfect. The data might not be perfect. Your strategy might not be perfect when it starts off. You're going to have to come up with multiple iterations over time, but you need to start investing in your internal capabilities to really assess climate risk internally. That's a big one.
You're the commercial strategy manager, right? So super curious to hear about your sales cycle and like how easy or hard have you found it to convince, you know, clients to jump on board and to get involved with this? It sounds like a bit of a no-brainer based on the tools you've described, but like, what has that process been like?
As a whole, there's a spectrum. And these companies are all over the spectrum. We'll meet with some companies who, you know, you can tell they already have a sustainability or an ESG or a climate specific team internally, and they're kind of driving the agenda. They've came out with, you know, specific climate reports. They've set ambitious targets as to when they want to achieve net zero and so on. And then you have other companies who, you know, have been perhaps pushed a bit more from a regulatory standpoint and obviously need a bit more support on that front. And that's fine. The one thing I like to say is, you look at all these functions internally within a firm or a company, you can't expect them to be climate scientists. So we have a huge role to play in educating their staff as well and ensuring that they have the proper tools to drive the agenda or have an impact. So one thing we like to do, we like to run a 2-hour workshop with some of our clients. And during that workshop, we'll have our chief product officer present or head of climate present as well, and really kind of provide as much information behind perhaps what are the do's and don'ts when it comes to assessing climate risk. We'll even equip them with a vendor assessment toolkit. You know, they'll have basically a set of 20 plus questions that they can ask when they're shopping around for third-party data suppliers. And that alone already, you know, that initial framework that we can provide them with goes a long way and they appreciate it.
Yeah, I have to ask you, you mentioned ESGs, and I feel like I've seen a couple of pieces like in The Economist talking about the fundamental contradiction of ESG as being laid bare, a recent piece that they produced. And then they had a piece, a special report back in July, where they talked about, you know, a broken system needing urgent repairs and ESG needs to be streamlined and stripped of sanctimoniousness and things like that. And they're really like calling into question this idea of like, can we count on for-profit companies to sort of invest in mitigating and, you know, hopefully eliminating climate change? So super curious to hear, like, it feels like when shit hits the fan and like the economy is, you know, in trouble, people start to maybe move away from some of their ESG goals and look away from like SDGs. What are you seeing in that space? Do you agree with The Economist or do you think, hey, you know, all engines forward, we're moving ahead with ESG goals? What's your take on that?
Well, ESG is quite vast, right? And we focus on the climate bit more than anything. But when you look at ESG as a whole, it could be a pretty daunting challenge that a lot of companies need to face. But the thing is, it's not going away. It is going to be a key focus. And as I mentioned earlier as well, you know, your initial strategy around ESG is not going to be perfect, and you can't wait until that strategy is perfect. So build that plan, be transparent about your progress. And yeah, you might take a bit of heat, but it gives you a good basis point on something to start, right? So that's kind of my take on ESG.
And are you seeing any movement in the market? Like you know, as things are getting a little bit tricky in the markets now, are you seeing companies like stay committed to the E and the ESG, or are you seeing movement away from it or towards it even? What's your sense?
I think this year is the ultimate test, really. We're past COVID. There is obviously the energy crisis tied to the conflict in Ukraine, and this is having a huge economic impact, but it doesn't seem as though it's slowed the agenda on the climate front, first and foremost. I mean, we have COP27 that's going to be taking place in a couple of weeks, where the focus is adaptation. So really focusing on the impacts of, you know, physical risk and extreme weather events on the economy. It seems as though the agenda is still moving forward. We're seeing the US implementing their exploratory exercise early next year, and it mandated 6 of the largest institutions or banks to participate in it. So it's nice to see that there is still some progress. You know, more than anything, we don't have a finite amount of time when it comes to, I guess, solving this crisis, right? So companies obviously have come out with some pretty, you know, defined or ambitious targets around climate, right? A lot of them set up a net zero target by 2050 at the very latest, and have promised to increase their investments in sustainable finance, right? It will be key to see exactly over time how they're progressing and how close they are to achieving those specific targets that they've set. The best way to really track that is keeping a close eye on their annual reports, their climate reports, and ensuring that these companies are as transparent as ever regarding those specific challenges that they're trying to, I guess, face.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and I like how you said it's sort of like the true test, right? Like when you know, chips are down in the economy, you know, how much do companies keep track of their, you know, their stated ESG goals, and how do they stay the course? But knowing that various audiences are watching, their customers, the broader public, the media, things like that. I saw a tweet the other day that was connected to about D&I, you know, diversity and inclusion goals, but it was like, what's wrong, hun? Like, you barely touched your 2020 D&I goals, you know, from, you know, that came out of the protest movement. Like, same thing with ESG. It's like, you made these bold statements, you know, how are you going to keep, you know, living up to what you committed to? Interesting stuff. Kat Hamilton from over at Force of Nature, and they're involved in kind of like more of the climate change activism space. And one of the things they're doing, you mentioned COP27, is they're doing these sort of youth-led climate cafes at COP27 to kind of, you know, get the youth agenda around climate change, you know, top of mind and into that space. I'm super curious to understand like where your work with Climate X and, you know, the companies and industries that you work with intersects, if at all, with these movements that are happening right now, many of them youth-led, things like Extinction Rebellion. Is there any sort of cross-pollination or interaction there that's happening between these activist movements around climate change and the work you do at Climate X?
Yeah, definitely. So there's definitely a lot of work that we do on that front. And the reason why is we work at this alone, we're definitely not going to solve it. So collaboration is definitely key. Like I said, this issue is bigger than us. So some of the, you know, there's some associations that we're currently working with, obviously TCFD being one of them. We're in associations with the disability rights in the UK, TNFD. So the whole topic around biodiversity is becoming more prominent. Sustainable development goals is another one. Leaders for Climate Action. We're also part of the Global Equality Collective. We're part of so many.
The interesting point too of like the hard, fast activist space where it's like, look, we need to just like completely cut off, you know, all contracts for oil exploration and gas and things like that. And like, you know, there's various different political stances you can take. But I think the space that you all are in is really interesting, obviously, because you want to sort of play ball and be in relationship with those other folks in the movement. But you're also working with companies towards like mitigation and like moving away and understanding, you know, the losses that can happen and look forward in terms of, you know, as you said, their launches of different products and services and the impact they'll have on the environment. So there's this middle space, which I find really fascinating, of like, how do we actually move from the current economy that's destroying the planet that we have to a future economy that is doing it less and or not at all, right? And I think that middle space is, I think, fascinating and ripe with a lot of innovation and a lot of, you know, just like really cool stuff happening. So
when you look at climate change, it's a lot bigger than us, right? And working at it alone is not going to lead to the results that we were looking for. We're proud to support the advancement of a lot of that positive climate action on the education, the diversity and inclusion front when it comes to climate technology. There's definitely a lot more work that we can do on that front, but some of the initial associations that we work with, sustainable development goals, obviously the TCFD, TNFD, right? When it comes to biodiversity, that's a big one and something we're looking into. Leaders for Climate Action is another one. And then another area that's pretty interesting that you kind of touched on is when you start looking, what are the areas that are going to be the most impacted by climate change in the future? And even at the present day, it's not necessarily, these first world countries or these developed countries, right? It's not going to be necessarily the US or the UK. Countries like, unfortunately, Pakistan, countries in Africa as well. And unfortunately, they don't necessarily have the same resources that a lot of westernized countries have. So one big area that we're going to have to focus on and we're looking into over the next year or so is how can we make this data a bit more available to these regions and help them mitigate their exposure to these various risks. So that's an area that we're going to be focused on in the next year or so.
It obviously sounds like it's something you are deeply passionate about. You mentioned moving from more of a finance background into this space. So what is it about the purpose of ClimateX and you as an individual that resonates so much is in terms of, the mission of ClimateX and what you're trying to achieve there?
First and foremost, we're a value-led and diverse team, and we're building a world-class team trying to solve a global problem. And you can't do that without building a team with people across different walks of life. And if you do that, well, then in the end, you're able to drive that diversity in thought. And with that comes obviously more innovative solutions. So that's kind of at the core of ClimateX.
There was ever an issue that requires a diversity of thought to be solved, and a global view of how we tackle this thing. I mean, it's climate change. So I really appreciate that perspective.
For sure. And I got to give, again, kudos to Lucky and Camille, because that's been ingrained since the very beginning. And also kudos to our team for really carrying it out over the last 18 months. Right? It's something that we're constantly working on. Like I said, there's definitely some areas that we need to improve on, but it's a top priority for us. And it's exciting. It's exciting to see where that journey is going to lead us in the next year or so.
Absolutely. It's got to be really going to get you out of bed every morning, and to know you're working with an incredibly diverse and talented team and you're solving one of the most fundamental problems that has ever faced humanity. If that doesn't excite someone, I feel like, what else will? Kudos to your team for tackling that particular problem in such a, noble way. Moving us into the lightning round. So this is where we're looking for sort of slightly more personal, interesting, cheeky questions, mostly about you and sort of your background and your interests. And we ask you just keep the answers crisp and we'll keep it moving through the lightning round. The first question is just so our audience can get to know you. What's a game-changing piece of technology that you use in your life?
Pretty boring, but I live on HubSpot more than anything. Calendly, no more pains around booking meetings. So Calendly has been a game changer, and Notion for anything, basically.
Those are all tools that we use pretty religiously. So definitely, I feel like I need to get more out of HubSpot than I do, but definitely Notion and Calendly we use all the time. So those are great answers. Along those lines, we're singing the praise of tech and we're believers in tech for good, but there's also always a human element. So what do you think is one problem that tech can't solve and why?
It's going to be a cheesy answer, but tech can definitely not buy us time. So we need to act fast.
That's interesting and right up the alley of climate change. Love that. We're a tech for good podcast, but we like to talk about tech for bad. What would you say is the evilest application of tech out there?
Interestingly enough, the recent acquisition of Roomba by Amazon, that freaked me out a little bit. I think there's some underlying reasons where there's rumors that, Amazon will now have an idea of what the square meterage of her flat is. I thought that was kind of cheeky.
That's a really interesting one. So is there a deeper problem there that you're worried about? Is it just corporate consolidation or dirty floors? What's the issue there?
Definitely not about the dirty floors. I think it's more, Amazon already has access to so much of her data. Now they'll have an idea of what her flat looks like. So it's just adding to it, but good move on their part, to be honest.
Yeah, the data that they have on sort of our buyer's intent is pretty scary when you think about it. Which reminds me, I need to order some new razors for my bed to lift my platform bed up. So thank you for that.
Honestly, the targeted ads I get as well are just shaming me on most of my most recent purchases. So I get that.
Totally. On the flip side of that question, if you could dream up a new tech product, what would it be and what problem would it solve and for whom?
One area where climate tech can really focus on is the built environment. When you look at the built environment, it generates nearly 50% of annual global CO2 emissions. And if you fast forward to 2040, approximately 2/3 of the global building stock will be buildings that exist today. And the solution to improve, especially on the energy efficiency front, or to cut down these emissions, is definitely not to tear down every building and rebuild it from scratch, right? So we need to find some solutions to facilitate the retrofitting of our current building to be more energy efficient in the future. And I think that's a huge challenge that a lot of real estate companies are facing. And I really hope to see, you know, a lot of innovative solutions. And there already is, but I want to see more of it.
You're speaking to the son of a former real estate agent in the States. And like, I just think the buildings piece and the real estate angle, and it's cool to see that ClimateX is working with that industry, is like so underreported, but also so critical in terms of the scale. I think I was reading the other day that like buildings account for something like 40% of our emissions or something like that. And it's just like how underattended, like, first of all, do people know that? Second of all, what's sort of being done about it? You know what I mean? So it's a fascinating area. Along those lines, we'd be curious to hear your predictions. You're working in a space where you guys are getting tons of data and information from all these different industries and different clients. It's really cool. So like, what are you seeing in the tea leaves, or, you know, in the water, so to speak, in terms of what's coming down the pipe? So what predictions would you make about your space in the coming year?
Regarding my space, maybe a bit less, but there's one report that came out, and I think it was Sifted, touching on venture capital going to all female founded companies. And I think in 2021, it was a pathetic 2%. Or 6.4 billion, which is nothing. And even worse from that, if you look back at the last time I think this assessment was taken, which was the peak of venture capital going to all female founded companies, was in 2009, and that was 2.8. So we actually saw a drop, and I find that unacceptable. I really hope that we're gonna see some change on that front.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely unacceptable, as you said, and just brutal that 51% of the population is getting 2% of the funding. And just this notion that, like, you know, the solutions are coming from the other 98% of just men trying to solve. And I think, talk about an issue, too, that, like, unfortunately, you know, climate change is, I think, in some ways, like, driven by a lot of, like, toxic masculinity and you know, hyper-capitalism and stuff. So, like, if ever there was an issue that we needed, you know, like, women's perspective and their brilliance to shine through and help us solve these problems, I think it's climate change. So well said there.
Yeah, definitely. I should preface also that stat is not necessarily just climate tech. It's tech as a whole, which is even worse.
Yeah, we're big fans of the folks at Sifted. We were just at their summit last week, and they produced some really brilliant research. So shout out to Sifted. Last question we'd like to ask, we're a Tech for Good podcast, and there's always this thread in Tech for Good of like trying to balance profit and purpose. You know, you said you used to work in finance, you want to keep the lights on, you want to make money, live a good life, but you also want to, you know, change the world, help people, help the planet. So like, how have you personally navigated those sort of priorities in your life?
First, I never worked in finance. So this was completely new to me when I actually pivoted from climate tech. Most of my experience was in consumer goods. And although it was a great school, I wasn't necessarily passionate about that specific area. So when I did make the move to London, it was definitely, you know, my opportunity to pivot into climate tech. And I was looking for something a bit more purposeful and something I could really soak my teeth in. It wasn't easy. Obviously, I made the move at the beginning of the pandemic. I had to get creative with, you know, my networking. And what I was noticing is, you know, a lot of these kind of startups in this space weren't necessarily keen on bringing me on board because I didn't have any of that prior experience, which is fair, right? Like, I completely understand that. When I met Lucky and, you know, he kind of presented me with this opportunity, I definitely seized it. I kind of just ran with it. And looking back at the 18 months that I've had with this company, the growth has been incredible. And I love the journey that I'm on. And the idea that we can have an impact and really drive change when it comes to, you know, driving that kind of climate agenda, that outweighs any type of profit that we can be getting.
Yeah, that's great. Well, really appreciate your time, Alex Kripal, the commercial strategy manager at ClimateX. This has been an awesome conversation, one that we haven't touched on yet. And I just think our audience is going to love all the things that you've shared. So thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Paul.
Well, and where can folks find more about ClimateX and the good work that you're doing on the interweb?
Obviously on our website, climatex.com, on our LinkedIn page. And if anyone is interested in even having a conversation or is looking to pivot into climate tech and don't necessarily know how to kind of approach that journey, don't hesitate to ping me on LinkedIn. I'm actually going to have a Calendly link. You can book some time there as well. And I'd be more than happy to have this conversation.
That's great that you offer that, because I always said to myself, you know, if this agency thing doesn't work out, or if we end up selling it in a couple of years, I think climate change, climate tech is probably like the next, you know, it just makes sense. It's the problem we need to solve. But yeah, something that myself and I know a lot of our listeners are super interested in. So good shout. And thanks for making yourself accessible and available.
Of course.
Awesome, Alex. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Paul.